I'm delighted to be here. I've tried to come and give this lecture in March to the CMU at Illinois chapter, and just the weather didn't cooperate from Atlanta, but I'm really glad to be back here. And just want to what I'm showing here is the cover of a recent issue of Places Journal that I co-guest edited on retrofitting suburbs, and I think my article, which is just one of many articles in that issue, was available to a lot of you as you came in. And so I want to give a slight caveat that basically this lecture is an elaborated and the newer research since then, but that article will be a kind of good takeaway because it covers a fair amount of, you know, what I'm going to talk about is also in that article. I've actually been, my co-guest editor, Jim Williamson, and I are working on a book on this subject, which we are hoping will go to press in about a month and a half, maybe two. We're not quite there yet. But so what we're really talking about, very specifically, is the redevelopment of prototypical suburban property types. Malls, office parks, garden apartment complexes, strip corridors, etc., into more sustainable, more urban formats. In this sense, when I refer to suburban retrofits, I'm not necessarily talking about locating in the suburbs. I'm not focusing on the location as defining what is suburban or what is urban. I'm talking about the form. So it's the prototypical property types that we've been developing for the last 50 years, but those that are the more suburban property types are those whose form is automobile reliant, intends to result in isolated object buildings surrounded mostly by parking. As more and more of these properties get retrofitted into more urban forms, not just renovated, is when they begin to open up the possibility of then beginning to think about how the context of the suburbs themselves are really changing and how we might begin to start retrofitting the suburbs themselves into more sustainable formats. So as you know, most early new urbanist projects were greenfields. They were built on undeveloped land that was a green field before the project started. Increasingly, as Mahinder points out earlier this morning, new urbanists have begun working in brownfields, the former industrial sites. The work I'm going to show focuses on the gray field projects, the projects characterized by big parking lots. We've been documenting these dramatic transformations of shopping malls, strip malls, industrial parks, parking lots. I'm just going to show you samples of several, point out the trends that we're finding in these redevelopment of individual projects, and then speculate about the broader implications. These projects are all just, they're happening. And in certain markets, they are happening everywhere. There are certain markets, it's the hot thing. But the question is to speculate about what are the implications? How can we connect the dots? How can we actually take more advantage as we try to look at what the regional implications, the larger place implications of going beyond the individual project to actually then thinking about what does it mean now to start thinking of our entire context retrofitting in certain ways. And then I hope to have some discussion for you to tell me about, you know, how is this playing out around here? What project should I be looking at here that I don't yet know about? So I always start with these, just the very simple, big questions. As you know, U.S. population is currently around 300 million and is expected to keep growing by nearly half again by 2050. Where will this additional population live and work? Can growth be directed to where it both contributes to economic development and inflicts the least environmental damage? Despite the resurgence of population in many downtowns in the last decade, the vast majority of development, from 75 to 90% in different parts of the country, has been suburban. Farmland is being converted to development at ever-increasing rates. In Atlanta, where I live, We are now only chopping down an average of 50 trees a day, 50 acres of trees a day. We're down from 54 at the height of the late 90s. But it's for, very lower and lower densities. And yet with population growing and growing, the questions of the sustainability of all this are certainly worth asking. I don't think it is sustainable, but it certainly is popular, and we can't forget that. But there are also increasing counter trends, and the question of what is going to continue to be popular or not is part of what we need to do as we plan ahead. Changing demographics, new markets, and new opportunities exist that, if adequately exploited, may allow existing suburban places to accommodate significant proportions of new growth and to themselves benefit from doing so. Both of these images, all four of these images, are from Dwani Slater's Iber, DPZ, and these are just proposing very modest retrofits. At the top, a simple liner strategy to transform a commercial strip dominated by parking lots into a more urban, more pedestrian-oriented spaces with buildings fronting tree-lined sidewalks. At the bottom is Mashpee Commons, really the first suburban retrofit. The before image on the left shows the 1960s shopping center as it was, surrounded by a parking lot, and then just a view of what replaced it, which was modeled after a much more traditional New England village of shops on a main street with apartments above. So what, in both of these cases, what makes the after condition more urban? We should all recognize, and I hope everyone in this room recognizes, that the after images on the right are more walkable, less auto-dependent. They're still auto-dependent, but they're less so. They have something of a mix of uses. They incorporate shaped figural space with the buildings as background and street trees instead of yard trees. Now, these seemingly merely aesthetic differences perform three fundamental steps in urbanizing suburbia. First and foremost, these steps reduce vehicle miles traveled, VMT, even if only by a very small fraction in these two particular examples. Mashpee Commons' incorporation of 13 apartments above a Talbot store was revolutionary at the time. In the late 70s, no one thought this would possibly make any sense at all. All of the experts just said, it hadn't been built, done in 50 years. No, you cannot lease an apartment. You can't build an apartment over a store. We don't do that. It's unheard of anymore. Well, they leased out within a month. The rent doubled within 2 years. Caught all the experts had been poo-pooing it, but anyway, those residents immediately recognized that they could substitute at least some of their driving trips with walking trips. Of the above example, the tree-lined streets of Apollo Beach would have increased the safety of walking to those shops, and presumably also resulted in at least some reduction of VMT, providing means for people to get out and share public space, whether sidewalks or transit, and all of which are very important to sustainability and to urbanization. We saw some of the studies that Kai's cited on the walkability, the studies that are really demonstrating those reductions in VMT. So this gets to the second step, which is, again, worth reiterating, this is sort of 101, I think, for all of us here, but the spatial integration of people and cars instead of their separation. Most of us probably changing generationally pretty quickly. But for a slightly older generation, being taught modern principles, rational principles of planning and modern urbanism, you were taught, for perfectly rational reasons, to separate people and cars. Why didn't you want to have pedestrians anywhere near a car? They'll get hit. You don't want the buildings too near the cars either, except as parking lots, where we surround them. But modern urbanism gives the streets over entirely to the cars and puts the people and the buildings on trails, raised walkways, plinths, underground concourses, megastructures, or superblocks. In a modern suburban development, the low densities don't tend to justify the kind of secondary pedestrian systems of all the walkways, the pedestrian connections that were always intended to make those modern systems work. And in the most urban conditions, did successfully do so. But in the suburban conditions, we almost never find the secondary pedestrian systems. In few cases we do, but not by and large. So the result of this safety-oriented thinking ends up being a landscape largely devoid of pedestrians at all. So just as the integration of uses is more urban because it allows for more synergy and social interaction, so is the integration of people and cars into streets that are treated as figural public spaces for multiple modes. And this, of course, is the third fundamental step of urbanization that Pender has already mentioned, the creation of public space. And it's important to distinguish here between communal space, which is of limited access, and true public space that invites participation by all without requiring assimilation or membership. Suburbia has plenty of communal space for shoppers, drivers, toddlers, skateboarders, soccer players, nature lovers, etc., etc. But what we don't see as much, and urban places are often just as bereft of these mixed, but the compactness of urban places tends to also compact those communal spaces to cohabit into much more public spaces that are mixing groups together. So much less exclusive. So urbanizing urbanizing existing suburbs is certainly not an easy task, and not all suburbs by any means should become urbanized. There will always be those suburbs that are highly valued, they work wonderfully, and they will continue to. But we've got a mindset in this country that makes even those suburbs that are struggling have a hard time making any kind of changes. American legal and cultural attitudes have long accepted the idea that cities are dynamic and expected to grow. But it's less obvious, but just as influential, is the expectation that suburbs are not expected to change or evolve over time. It's an expectation that somehow a suburb, once it's up, I have a right to maintain this exactly as it is. Whereas in the city, we expect to see the cranes, and expect to see change. And so from NIMBY protection of property values to particular street patterns, land uses, subdivision regulations, and building types, the suburbs are both culturally and physically highly resistant to change. However, what we've been starting to see over the last 10, 15 years is many older suburbs increasingly recognize that not only has their economic status within the old monocentric core periphery regional model already significantly changed, they're beginning to see that physical change is in fact vital to their interests. The out-of-date and aging buildings of many older suburbs no longer accommodate contemporary tastes and needs. They've been bypassed for several decades now by new developments leapfrogging out into the exurbs. Ironically, however, that very leapfrogging that contributed to the inner suburbs' decline is now providing them with a relatively central location. While the first ring suburbs were originally developed as more or less bedroom communities out at the edge, they've now become conveniently adjacent to much of the polycentric growth beyond the urban core and are ripe for redevelopment. Surprisingly, newer sprawlscapes, a lot of them are sprawlscapes, bursting with office workers and retail, but also congested with extreme traffic, inadequate affordable housing, and a lack of open space, are also retrofitting. So the first-ring suburbs are often sort of the canaries in the coal mine. They're the ones where we see the blight and it attracts attention. You can see there's a problem there that really needs to be solved. The newer suburbs often are, the traffic is certainly the problem that people recognize, or the schools that are now filled with trailers because they can't keep up. There are signals as well. But you don't always tend to recognize that there's a problem so much in the newer suburbs. But in both cases, the older and the newer suburbs are beginning to recognize that as land value goes up, those big surface parking lots just don't make as much sense as they used to. And by densifying the underperforming asphalt, which is what the developers, they're looking around and they're seeing a lot of it, underperforming asphalt, densifying it with new uses and providing parking garages wrapped with more urban buildings, cities and developers are able to accommodate more people, more activities, and even more green space into those existing suburban sites. So in brief, the conditions that are really driving these retrofits are kind of number one, aging, out-of-date properties, often in the first-ring suburbs. And what you find is that fear of blight actually trumps the usual sort of NIMBY concerns and begins to trigger a lot of more public-private partnerships. The same groups that might ordinarily completely fight density of any kind in not in my backyard, that's out of keeping with the character of our neighborhood. If they've got a dead mall, hey, we'll take not anything, but suddenly the first preference will be, we just want someone to fix that mall. Bring in someone who's going to redevelop that mall. Well, the big headline from last year, one new enclosed mall in the entire U.S. A whole lot of lifestyle centers, but only one enclosed mall. No, you're not going to find somebody to go in and fix that mall as it's in its mall format. So beginning to recognize that suddenly, okay, well, we really don't want a dead mall there. That's bringing property value down. Suddenly now you find neighbors a lot more supportive and willing to begin, who would normally fight density, suddenly often actually becoming great advocates and recognize, once they kind of get over the initial understanding that they may not be able to see that development stay in its initial form, they have a hard time getting over their resistance to change, but once they've kind of gotten over that hump, you see things do change. Booming new agglomerations, often in edge cities or edgeless cities, we're seeing that concern over traffic and air quality begins to trigger a lot more interest in transit-oriented development. A lot of the edge cities are beginning to get transit now. It's pretty expensive to do an after-the-fact fix, but there's almost every edge city. We haven't had time to go back and research all 183 of the edge cities that Joel Garreau listed in his 1989 book, but they're all 20 years old now, they're all repositioning, and most of them are actually adding transit in a big way. And they're finding that they just can't afford the underperforming asphalt. There's a lot of market-driven mixed use now coming into edge cities. Another interesting driver is the changing economic identity of the suburbs and a desire for distinction. As I said, a lot of these suburbs that started as bedroom suburbs, their identity was really tied to that. They saw themselves, understood themselves as peripheral to the core city. Well, now they're sort of central within the region, and they have begun to become economic engines in their own right. They've got some office parks, they've got some development. They suddenly find themselves actually competing with other towns to try to attract more commercial uses. They suddenly find the identity that they need to market themselves is now a different identity than what it used to be. And they need to think of themselves as a destination for other people, not just a destination for their own residents. And that begins to change how they start thinking about public space, how they start thinking about themselves. Changing demographics and markets is a big one, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. There's a huge growing market for more urban housing types and places, even within suburban markets, where one didn't used to see that market demand. And then lastly, smart growth practices and policies, especially the arrival of transit. I'd say if the number one driver of retrofit is an aging, out-of-date property, such as a dead mall, The number two is the arrival of transit and the opportunities then for really developing a lot more TOD and accommodating affordable housing. So by far though, as I said, the biggest driver has been the proliferation of dead malls. Real estate analysts working in collaboration with CMU reported in 2001 nearly 20% of America's regional malls were dead or dying. This was in addition to the estimated 50 empty regional malls already just sitting on the landscape, and over 1,000 ghost boxes, the former big box stores. Now, that was 2001, and what we've been doing is going back and now finding out what's happened to a lot of those. And it's pretty amazing what's happened. Most of them are getting redeveloped. So these are a couple of some slides of just some of the strategies for what to do with either a dead mall, shown on the left, or a thriving mall, shown on the right, in order to remake it into an urban mixed-use node or town center. The diagrams on the left by Dover Cole with Glad and Jackson proposed phases for dealing with a dead mall. First, demolish most of the mall, but renovate the department store. Any of the two-story buildings would tend to be much better built, and they can certainly accommodate new uses. The single-story stuff, almost always you're going to end up just demolishing. Then, number two, and this is important, take advantage of the overparked pre-68 standards. Pre-1968, the standards for retail were 10 parking spaces per 1,000 square foot of retail, instead of today's 4 or even 3 if you're in a mixed-use district. So the reality is you can actually start building on that parking lot with additional uses without having to provide additional parking. The first phase is free in that sense. Once you've gotten that first phase of some additional mixed uses in, then, okay, you've got to bite the bullet and somebody's got to pay for building a parking garage that you're now going to fit, but then you can begin wrapping up the parking decks with housing. Establishing all the secondary, the street system, a series of blocks, series of public spaces, and really adding liner buildings, you establish a new street grid, a new main street. On the left are diagrams by Duane Clater-Seifer, which are similarly add to a thriving mall by also establishing streets in the parking lot and connecting into neighboring streets. And what's particularly interesting, I think, in the DPC example is how much is the importance of connecting the streets to the internal pedestrian system of the existing mall. So if you look at that mall as pedestrian space of the mall, and that becomes the key, the initial step to the whole linkage of the system. Both diagrams and both sort of systems really are about establishing public greens and plazas as focal points for new, compact, mixed-use neighborhoods with greater density, walkability, and local connectivity. Unless they completely scrape all of the existing buildings, which is really a shame. I hate seeing that happen, because that's certainly not the most sustainable strategy. But most of the case, this stuff is not, as we know, it's not built well to last, and it can't really sustain. You can't build on top of most of it, although I have one example that does. What's interesting is actually how much retrofit has to work with far more existing conditions than a typical greenfield project, and especially those that are multiple parcels. And so, as a result, retrofit has to get really particularized. You don't tend to see them quite as formulaic. They're not plugging down, exactly the same template in one part of the country as in another. So that they're able to then start to really tie into local conditions and become much more particularized places. And I try to really encourage that to happen as much as possible. It doesn't always, but sometimes the people are just scraping them clean and pretty much imposing another pretty standard, a new template for the old.